This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. It happened several weeks ago. My quiet walk to work changed radically. All of a sudden, as if a switch was flipped, I had a soundtrack to accompany me. Blaring through Mother Nature's speakers was the amplified song of scores of birds. It was amazing. And on the way home, all of a sudden, off in the distance, I heard honking, not cars, Canada geese. All this is happening because tiny little switches in millions of birds have been flipped that signal that it's time to head north. And when the birds start singing, it means we get to have bird diva Bridget Butler back on with us to discuss bird migration and behaviors. Bridget, great to have you back on the Vermont Edition.
Rick, this is a treat. I don't normally get to hang out with you.
I know.
Can't wait to talk birds with you today.
This is so much fun. And listeners, you can jump right in with your questions for Bridget. You can share them with us, what you've observed in your backyard or walks through the woods. Here's how you do it. You call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also send your emails to vermontedition@vpr.net. And first of all, Bridget, I want to start with an email from Megan. This is beautiful. She says, during a walk this morning to the post office, there were a couple of places where cedar waxwings filled the trees. From far away, I couldn't figure out what kind of birds they were from their delightful song. But as I got closer, I could see hundreds of the gorgeous birds. It's nice to have them around again.
Yeah. You know, and what's funny is we're not going to have those guys around much longer because those guys are actually going to push further north. So our waxwing buddies that have been hanging out with us for the wintertime, as they push down here to kind of take advantage of all of the fruits that are on the different trees, they're going to be kind of pushing further north. So it's not normally a bird that we're going to have breeding here in large numbers. So we have cedar waxwings, and then we have the little bit bigger ones, the Bohemian waxwings. Mm. So those guys, the difference between the two is size, but it's also, well, it's the color of their butts.
Yeah, describe the bird itself overall so people can
recognize
them.
So this is a beautiful kind of, I always think of this bird as a silky bird. Mm. So they're kind of this top brown color, black mask. They have a crest to them. They have these beautiful little yellow dots along the wings, along the edge of the wings, and red as well. And then the butt part, right? So the part, bird butt is the part right under the tail. So we call that the undertail coverts if we want to be proper ornithologists.
But we can call it the butt today.
We could call it the butt, right? Because then you know where to look.
Right.
So oftentimes that spot is the spot that you get to see because you're looking up, right?
Right.
But it can also be a really good identification characteristic. So what color is that spot right where kind of the tail meets the body? And for Bohemian waxwings, it's a rusty red bird. Brown, and for cedar waxwings, it's a white. So there is a little bit of a size difference between the cedar and the Bohemian. They look really similar otherwise, but if you look at that undertail covert section, the butt, then you'll be able to tell which one's which. And all these guys are going to be moving further north to breed. In fact, the Bohemian waxwing doesn't even hang out on this coast. So they're going to push further west and further north to breed for their summer season.
Well, let's talk about migration. First of all, I want to know what makes these birds come back north. I'm a bird, right?
Yeah.
It's warm and lush in the southern climes. Why do I leave?
I know. I want to come back. Yeah. So it's all about kind of dispersing so that you can take advantage of food availability and raise your young. Right. So not enough space down there in the tropics for everybody to compete when it comes time to breed. So they're going to push back. And not all of our birds are going to the tropics either. We have short distant migrants as well. If we think about red-winged blackbirds and some of the birds that are the first ones to show up, they're going to stay within the continental U.S. And not push as far away, far south. But it is. It's a response to light cues. It's a response to food. And it's that need to breed. And so they have special niches and special habitats that they're going to fill in order to maximize that breeding success.
I know you're going to throw your bird book at me when I ask this question.
No.
But as birds get older, do they get like humans? Do they prefer to stay down south and bag flying the thousands of miles northwards?
Man, I don't.
Do they become,
lazy?
Like,
no.
Yeah, right.
No. No, yeah, that's a really interesting question. I've never really thought about that. I don't think so. I think there's still this innate push to move to where, because it may not always be about breeding at that point, but it may be more about food availability. And what's kind of cool is some of these birds shift what they eat depending on what's available. And so as we get into the insect season, you know, we've seen, man, I was down at the lake the other day with the kiddos, and they were like literally kind of pushing their way through clouds and clouds of insects. And so we have all of this bounty of food available that's coming. And so birds are going to try and take advantage of that.
Okay. So you told us about cedar waxwings. What other birds are just passing through and heading farther north?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So like right now, this is when birders get like crazy because it's the time when you just want to quit work and go out birding like all the time. And especially for some of these birds that are going to be breeding further north from here in the boreal forest and even in the tundra, right? So you have these beautiful little sets of warblers. The wood warblers are these tiny little birds, beautiful colors like oranges and yellows and yellow greens and olive tones and even some blues in there. So these guys, there's some of them that are going to push through here. And right now, the ones to look for, there's the palm warbler, which is this lovely streaky warbler with a rusty red cap to it. And these guys, and they have yellow, beautiful yellow across the chest, and they wag their tail. So that's a really great key indicator for these guys. And they're just pushing through. So they're going to be along some of our waterways and wetlands. I think of Herrick's Cove as one of my favorite spots down in the southern part of the state to go and look for these guys. So shrubby, scrubby areas where they can get a lot of that insect food and then kind of blow through to get up to their breeding grounds. Pine warblers, another one of them. I'm trying to think of who else would be just kind of, oh, white-crowned sparrow, like these dapper little sparrows. So we normally think of sparrows as being these drab little brown streaky jobs, but the white-crowned sparrow has these beautiful streaks across the top of the head, sharp black and white outline. And that is a sharp, sharp bird. My mom and I have this competition every year with our feeders still out, and she's like, I got my white-crowned sparrows. And I'm like, I don't. I'm coming over. So there's like this moment right now during this time of year where we're not only getting the birds that are going to hang out with us, but we're getting these little gems that are going to bop through, and you got to catch them at the right time.
And as they bop through, how long do they stick around in our general area? Like that white-crowned sparrow is going to be at your mom's house for how long?
Maybe a couple weeks, and then just kind of push on. You know, and that's weather-dependent too. So when we have these weather fronts that move through, you want to pay attention to those. When the weather's pushing from the south up into this area, that's going to mean that the birds are going to push with that. You can actually use weather radar to track bird migration as well. So you can dive as deep as you want into this or stay right on the surface if you want and just, you know, have that cup of coffee in your backyard enjoying whatever the twittering is. Or you can dig real deep and see what happens.
Well, we did hear from Nichol in Guilford who says he doesn't really know much about birds, but he loves listening to the bird show because it kind of clues him into what's around him at
this time
of year. Isn't that great? Listeners, today you have the excellent opportunity to have your questions answered or get advice from an actual bird expert, Bridget Butler. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your comments or questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Now, you also mentioned, you know, I keep saying our birds going to the tropics.
Yeah.
But you said some go shorter distances. So our Vermont birds or birds of this region that migrate south, where are they hanging out in the winter?
Oh, my gosh. Right. That depends on which bird you're picking, right? So some of these wood warblers, we call them neotropical migrants. And a lot of those birds are going to go down into South and Central America. But then, you know, we have birds like robins. What we think of as our robins that were still here during the winter are short distance migrants. So they're just going to move to where there's food availability. And we actually have robins that will be here throughout the winter. I had huge flocks of robins in my neighborhood, and I'm in downtown St. Albans. And the one common denominator there was ornamental crab apples and mountain ash trees that have been planted in different backyards there. So they stick around. So, you know, you really got to pick and choose which bird, but they go in so many different directions and so many different places. And we even have birds that get off track, like the painted bunting that was seen recently.
In Pittsford.
That was amazing. I didn't get to go see it, which is unfortunate because, right, the moment that you get the time to go and see it, you got to go when the bird's there. And that bird was gone pretty quickly. That's a bird that should be further south of here. But for some reason, whether it was weather or otherwise, ended up, luckily, in Pittsford, Vermont.
Well, we had this very warm winter. Does that affect the birds who stay here all winter?
Yeah. So this was really cool. I love tracking this kind of stuff. And there are a number of different projects out there that we birders can get involved in, or even just bird watchers, folks that are connecting with birds that will help us kind of answer some of those questions. That's a tough one, right? So we look at this winter and we go, oh, it was really, it wasn't as wintry as we wanted it to be. It was a mild, mild winter. So that means, birds are going to come back earlier, or all of these different things. What we need is data over a series of years that we can compare. And what I've been doing at my house is not only contributing to eBird or projects like the Great Backyard Bird Count, which happens in February, which can give us an idea of resident birds, but keeping track of stuff right in my own backyard and writing down the date of when it arrives back. So this year for us, the red-winged blackbird arrived in our yard probably about 2 or 3 weeks earlier. Mm. But the white-throated sparrow, who showed up this morning, like, I literally had to throw the window open because I heard that, oh, sweet Canada, Canada, Canada. And I was like, oh, it's back, it's back. And I ran and I wrote it down on our list for right now. And then I ran to our old list, which is posted in another part of the house. And I compared, and they're right on time.
Oh my.
So some of the birds that we're going to see, maybe a shift. And I think red-winged blackbirds, because they're not migrating so far, they probably could feel the weather being all right, feel the food source kind of thing being all right, and maybe moved a couple weeks earlier. But other birds, especially those that, are coming back from South America and Central America and all those beautiful, warm places, they're right on time. So this week, we're getting some of the swallows back, like the tree swallows and the barn swallows. Lots of people posting pictures of those online. Louisiana water thrush, which is a beautiful little bird that loves to be by brooks, wooded brooks. So people are starting to hear that bird right now. So those guys are all right on time. I think what we need to do is take this winter into account and then see what happens, along a longer timeline. Yep. I know probably the birds this winter had an easier time finding food. We had goldfinches will move out if there's really deep snow because they can't get at any seed. But we had those at our feeder all year. So it kind of goes back and forth. It's going to be weather dependent. This weather was weird this year. But I think, again, we have to look at the big picture, and we can be part of that by helping to collect data and sharing it with websites like eBird or the Great Backyard Bird Count.
We've got bird diva Bridget Butler here today, and Bridget, the phones are lit. So we better get some calls. Let's start with Donna in Burlington. Donna, thanks so much for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment for Bridget?
Oh, I have a comment, actually. I work at the hospital in Burlington, and I am at the big information desk. The minute you walk through the front door, you see me. And I have a beautiful view of the outside, which is wonderful. And we have trees that are lining where the bus stop is there between us and the Gibbon Medical Center. And I thought I had encountered a lot of different situations, and maybe all of them, but I'm always surprised. So people have been coming in and commenting on the birds. We have cedar waxwings. You were talking about cedar waxwings earlier.
Yeah.
And what's happening is they're coming and they're gorging themselves on these berries on these trees that are lining the path. And they're just, and people have been so concerned. They come in, they say, there are dead birds. They're just laying all over the ground, And what it is they've been gorging on these berries, and they're getting drunk. They're fermented berries.
You know it.
So they're ending up on the ground, and it's the funniest thing. We're telling people, don't be too concerned. They're probably all right, But I say to myself, oh, who do I contact about this?
Well, can they sleep this off? Do they wake up with little birdie hangovers?
Yeah, probably with a little bit of a hangover, too. They can eat so much that they're just, weighted down, heavy. You described it exactly right, gorging on all of this fruit. And because we've had, even though it was a mild winter, we've had the freeze-thaw happen, and that ferments the berries. So the best thing that you can do is create a little waxwing drunk tank and get them off of the ground. I mean, this is the thing I always think about, especially in neighborhoods where there are cats that are out. The bird needs a little bit of time to shake that off, and you want that bird to be in a safe spot. So if you can keep an eye on them, that's great. If you can get them up off the ground, that's even better. I've moved birds into shrub-like areas so they have a little bit of cover and they're going to be a little bit safer, so they'll do all right. But enjoy the antics, man. They are just, they're almost acrobatic when they're eating some of these berries, and maybe that's due in part to the fermentation. They just get really super playful, but they'll toss berries up and catch them, and it's just, it's really fabulous. Fascinating.
Okay. And Donna, you might want to start a small urn of black coffee. let's talk to James in Burlington. James, how you doing? Thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment for Bridget?
Hey, Bridget, how are you? I'm just curious. I've heard that flamingos can actually migrate up to Vermont. I didn't know if there was any truth to this, and if so, where we could find them.
Geez, I would be so shocked if that happened. But, you know, anything's possible, I guess. I really don't think flamingos are going to migrate to this area at all. Not the right food source for them. Their bill is designed to be able to sift and filter food out of the water and out of the mud. And we just don't have the right climate for them. You know, at the same time, you know, we have sandhill cranes in Vermont, and we have sandhill cranes breeding in Vermont. And that was a bird at one time that if you had called, I probably would have said, yeah, no, not likely, because their core breeding population is very far from here. So anything's possible.
How far north would a flamingo tend to go?
I have no idea.
Okay.
No clue.
All right. We'll research that. Let's talk to John in Richmond. John, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Well, thank you. And Bridget, I just love listening to this show. I've caught it for the last 3 or 4 years.
It's well, great. Thank you.
My question is, where have all the kestrels gone? Uh-huh. I haven't seen any in at least 3 years. I used to see them all the time coming from Burlington along 89, and I haven't seen any in a long time.
Yeah, you know, and what's great, I got to tell you, it's okay, because I've seen a lot in the past week, which is kind of the reverse of what you're saying. I've been seeing more, and I don't know if that's just because I'm attuned to them, because I saw one and now I'm really looking for them. But there are two things that could probably affect the kestrel population. You know, one is nesting, and these guys are cavity nesters. So as trees age and turn into what we call snags, which are really great for wildlife, and they become hollowed out by woodpeckers, they provide wonderful nesting spots for birds like kestrels and some of our owls and chickadees, and there's a whole list, wood ducks included. And if those snags are removed from a property, or if they fall to the ground and that snag is not available anymore with a nesting cavity, then the birds are going to move on and find someplace else. The other bit is kestrels are, they like to eat insects as well. And so as we choose to use things that might be harmful to insects, like pesticides, those insects are going to disappear across the landscape and make it harder. We're actually seeing a decline in a lot of the birds that are insectivores, including some of the flycatchers and swallows. We're not sure what's attributed to yet, but we can start to kind of tease that apart and see if pesticides are part of that mix. One of the things you can do to help kestrels is build nest boxes and put them up. So the Audubon Society, National Audubon Society, the Nest Watch Program, also from Cornell Lab of Ornithology, has some wonderful patterns online so that you can build a kestrel nesting box and bring them back to those places where you miss them now.
Ah, what a great idea. Today is our spring bird migration show. We're talking with bird diva Bridget Butler. Coming up, we'll discuss respecting the breeding areas of certain birds. And we want to hear from you about the birds you've spotted or the niggling questions you have about bird behavior. You can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Rick Zingari. This is Vermont Edition. Bird diva Bridget Butler is with us today, and you can let us know what questions you have about the birds in your backyard. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Now, I actually found a few things in the newspapers this week about birds. So first of all, I was home in Pennsylvania, and in the Allentown Morning Call, there was this headline on Saturday, "Surly Geese Return to Salisbury Township." In the article, they called the geese feathered culprits that attacked a person, and one person had to use pepper spray on the goose. So I'm wondering, first of all, are we being tolerant enough for birds as they're passing through the area? I know, like, migrating birds, sometimes in the past they had plenty of areas they could stop. You know, there was water, which is gone now, and now they're probably closer to populations and homes.
Yeah, you heard me do heavy sigh there with that.
Yeah, I heard that.
That's like, so, okay, surly geese, and they're like culprits. Well, let's like, if we look at this in the big picture, what are they trying to do this time of year? They're trying to mate, and that mating then leads to babies, right? And so it's all about protecting your territory, protecting your young, maybe even protecting your food source. And so I think it's really unfortunate that we use those adjectives to describe birds, or even, I even think of any wildlife. I think about, you know, how we describe fishers as being vicious. Well, they're just trying to do what they need to do to survive. And sometimes when our habitat overlaps their habitat, we need to be a little bit more understanding of what their needs are, and be able to give them the space that they need. It makes for a really entertaining YouTube video or whatever, but you're causing stress to that animal. And you're also putting yourself in danger, really, because they can be very aggressive, but for good reason. So let's just give them the space that they need. If geese are showing up in a space that is not safe for the public, then you need to call the state or a wildlife rehabilitator or someone with some expertise on how to deal with that safely. Don't put yourself in that situation.
And put away the pepper spray.
Yeah.
Well, that
brings
me to this next question. A listener in Middlebury emailed, says, do you have any suggestions for how to discourage house sparrows from eating the flower buds on my forsythia bush? There is absolutely no question that these sparrows strip and eat the flower buds all winter long. I've watched these nuisance birds sit on branches and literally strip the buds. Leaves then appear on this bush normally, and it appears to be a healthy bush otherwise. This destructive activity has been going on since the flock of house sparrows moved into the neighborhood about 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Is that destructive behavior? Or
so
is
that's
sparrows
frustrating.
Being sparrows.
Right. It's sparrows being sparrows. And then, like, if we break this one down, right, house sparrows are actually an introduced species to the Americas. So they were brought over here, and they are considered a pest. And they're a pest not only for people, but they're a pest for other songbirds. And so they're one of the birds that when we do nesting projects and such, it's actually all right to clear nesting material out from house sparrows when you find them in bird boxes and such, because it's not a bird that's protected by the Migratory Bird Act. So let's see, forsythia bushes, what would I do to discourage those birds? I think my first approach might be to try some type of netting that would cover the bushes and protect the buds and keep the sparrows away. The next thing I might do is try to come up with some kind of visual cue that would disturb the birds from that area and encourage them not to be there. There's some wonderful garden yard ornaments sometimes that have a reflective or refract. Is that the right word? The light, and might disturb them enough to get them to go away. Again, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology site has some really great ideas on how to discourage these birds, because they're very interested in helping encourage, especially cavity nesting birds, to have successes.
Well, these last couple of questions do kind of pose the question about bird ethics. Is there a code we should be honoring?
I mean, yes, raise your right hand.
Yeah, do we have some agreement with the birds?
Yes, we do. So there is a birder's code of ethics. And I think it's something that comes naturally for some of us. And then again, maybe not so naturally. And so it's a good thing for birders to review, I think, frequently. And for those of us who are in positions like me, who go out and do talks and walks and things like that, is to bring these things to our conversations about birds. So the American Birding Association does have a code of ethics that you can find online. It's like a one-page thing. It has four key parts to it. The first one is to promote the welfare of birds and their environment. And what this kind of boils down to is a couple of things, thinking about how we not only support the protection of birds and their habitat, but how we kind of minimize our impact when we're trying to enjoy them. So if we're a photographer, if we're a bird walk leader, if we're just a birder, how do we think about putting the bird first and not our needs to either see the bird or get the great photo or whatnot? And there are ways that we can learn when we're stressing birds. So birds have alarm calls, and they sound stressful. So even if you think about chickadees and titmice, when they get into an agitated state, that call becomes very quick and sharp and scolding. We've had some instances with a pair of nesting bald eagles in the state recently where folks have been more interested in seeing the bald eagles and getting close to them. And they've forgotten not only about the birds, but this next part of the birder's code of ethic, which is respecting the law and the rights of others. So that bird is nesting on somebody's property. And you don't necessarily have permission to go on that property. You might even have to pull over on the side of the road in a way that's not safe. So thinking about respecting the laws and the rights of others. I read this really cool piece about a bird that showed up that was really unique in Maine. And the birding community called the police department to let them know that this bird had showed up. So that when all of us show up with our geeky outfits and our binoculars on and we're scoping in somebody's neighborhood, people don't freak out and the police know what's going on. Great. So we need to keep that in mind. You know, the other two are ensuring feeders, nest structures, and things are safe. And then when you're birding in a group, to respect all the other parts of the code. But I think the big piece right now, especially we get so excited and we want to connect and we want to see those things, but you got to go back to thinking about what the birds are trying to do and take a couple steps back. That's why we have binoculars. That's why we have scopes. And that's why we have audio recording devices so that we can capture those things that we're so passionate about.
Love it. Great advice. Let's go back to the calls. We have Sue calling from Essex, New York. Sue, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Yes. Hi. I live in a wetlands area, and exactly 2 weeks ago today, I saw a large bird fly off our back pond, and it looked exactly like the great blue heron, except it was completely white. And when I looked it up in my bird book, I kind of narrowed it down to the great egret or the great white heron, and I didn't see the legs, so I know that would help differentiate. And am I in the right ballpark that it might be one of those two birds?
You got it. Yeah, okay. I think you're in a really great ballpark. That's a really good one. I mean, you can't really go wrong with the body shape of any of these wading birds, and especially something that's heron-sized. So great blue herons are going to be arriving back. I think April is definitely the month for them. But we have great egrets and we have snowy egrets, which you can see. And you're right, the feet are going to be a good key. And Rick, this is something that I've been really getting into lately, which is like fine-tuning my eye. And I have to do it over and over again each season. But like with egrets and the herons, one of the great places to look, and even shorebirds, is make sure you get a good look at their legs and you see what color they are. Because the snowy egret looks like it has black legs, but then it has yellow feet, which is kind of cool. And the great egret doesn't have those yellow feet. So immediately, if you can get a look at their feet, you're going to be able to tell the difference between the two. Also looking at like the bill and what's going on around the bill. Are there different colors that kind of help you can lock in that ID is another good one as well. So I think maybe either a great egret or a snowy egret. Bust out your bird book. Learn specifically where you can look. I would look at like the beak and the feet to kind of help you fine-tune that ID.
And I should mention, as much as the bird diva knows, she is sitting here with several books scattered in front of us. 2 minutes before the show, she was paging through getting ready. So let's take another call. Terry is calling from Rouse's Point, New York. Terry, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Yeah, guys, thanks for taking my call. I put a bird feeder up so we could see it from the dining room table, and all the birds get along great, except when there's one blue jay in there, no one else will come around. I'll wait until he's done. Is the blue jay an aggressive bird?
Yes. He is like the bully of the bird feeder world for sure. And he's a big gulper. They can gulp down lots of seed and then they like to cache it and stash it in different places. So yeah, that bird, I mean, bigger than the other ones, he's going to take precedent over all the other birds at your feeder. Another cool thing to watch for at your bird is figure out who the dominant chickadee is at your feeder, because they have a hierarchy and they have to take turns. And so if you see a little skirmish between chickadees, that's because somebody's not following the rules for whose turn it is next.
All right. Tina's calling from Lincoln. Tina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your question?
So I just wanted to say I was in Ecuador this winter, and you guys were talking about neotropical cormorants a while back, and I was straining because I wasn't familiar with a lot of the birds that that exist in Ecuador. And then I saw a Blackburnian warbler, and it was very exciting.
Yeah, so these neotropical migrants, and I don't know if you said cormorant or migrant. Maybe I misheard you, but those neotropical migrants are birds that kind of have a foot in both worlds. So that Blackburnian warbler that breeds up here is going to be hanging out in Ecuador in the winter. And it's one of my big goals. I'm very jealous of you right now, Tina, because I want to be able to see some of the birds that fascinate me so much that breed here in their wintering grounds, because I just think it would be fascinating to see them in a completely different habitat.
Now, we had a couple emails of concern.
Uh-oh.
First of all, Ryan posted online, "Where are the birds? The lack of bird sounds as compared to even a few years ago is alarming. I stepped out my door here in the Morrisville area on Saturday morning, and for almost an hour, I really only heard a few black-capped chickadees. Is this the new norm?" And Dave agrees. He wrote this list. He wrote, "Birds that disappeared in Shrewsbury, barn swallows, gone 15 years ago, evening grosbeaks, last seen 2005, kingbirds, kingfisher, hermit thrush, all 25% of former levels, ovenbirds, same as thrush, and bobolinks, 90% gone." What do you think?
Boom. Yes. Birds are declining. And, you know, Audubon has put out a couple of great reports in the past couple of years about what common birds are in decline, birds that are climate threatened, as we think about how climate change is going to affect some of these birds. So you named, you know, barn swallow, grosbeak. Those are two birds where we're that swallow group and the grosbeak group are very insect dependent. Grosbeaks really like, and of course it went right out of my head, but there's a pine beetle that those guys really rely on, and barn swallows, aerial insects. So as we see things shift and change, we are going to see a drop in some of these species, and we're also going to see species kind of move into our area that we normally considered southern species. Now, again, like I think, When we look at things, we have to look at the big picture. So the first gentleman that wrote in about the lack of bird song, you know, I'm hearing from other people that it's just crazy loud, you know, and they're really excited. I, you know, in my own backyard, I'm kind of noticing more birds showing up even in an urban environment than I did last year. Now, is that just because I'm paying better attention this year than last year, or I'm missing certain birds? I don't really know. And so I've got to keep that data going year after year, and then I'll be able to look at it a little bit better. Gotcha. But we are seeing birds in decline, and I think one of the great things that we can do is kind of focus on birds in their core breeding hat here in Vermont, and then we can look for ways to kind of, well, pay it forward for the birds. If we're passionate about them, what can we do? What can we do in our backyard? Can we tweak some of the landscape? If we're a landowner, can we look at bird-friendly management practices? If we have wetlands, what can we do to protect them in our community? Because, man, not only are they great for birds, but as we think about climate, we're going to have increased flood events as well. So some of these things really go hand in hand. When we're passionate about birds and we think about the habitat that we're in and we can apply some habitat protection there, there's a bunch of different payoffs.
We've got Bridget Butler here with us. We're going to take a break right now, but listeners, still a chance to get a call in at 1-800-639-2211. You know what I'm giving? I'm giving the
You could donate still
drive,
if you want to.
639-2211. And there's a new game in town. It's called Stump the Bird Diva, and Bridget Butler will tell us all about it. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. Bridget Butler, the Bird Diva, is with us today to answer your questions about bird behavior. The actual number to call is 1-800-639-2211. You can also tweet at Vermont Edition. And Bridget, I mentioned a little earlier a couple newspaper items that I came across this weekend.
Got another one.
This one was in the Boston Globe, the Sunday Boston Globe, and it's a column called Bird Sightings.
Yeah.
Which is pretty wonderful.
And you know what I'm noticing right there? What do you notice, Rick? In that picture, there's a white bird with a long bill, long legs, and what color are the feet?
Yellow. There's a snowy egret.
There we go. Snowy
Six
egret.
Of them were spotted in Quincy, Mass.
Cool.
And it's really neat because it's the Massachusetts Audubon Society who gets that done each week. Two blue-winged teals and eight piping plovers were spotted in Winthrop. So do Vermont birders have a place they can go to learn of sightings like this?
Yeah. So there's a bunch of different – there's a bunch of great places. So the Vermont Birding Facebook page is awesome, and people are posting photos all the time, and the community is so great at, like, helping each other figure out what the bird is. And not only that, but then to share those tips for why you think it's that bird and the way to look at that bird. So I love the Vermont Birding Facebook community. There's also the Vermont Bird Listserv, which is another great kind of classic email listserv that you can get on where people are reporting what they're seeing and finding. And the other thing I really like to do is I like to go on eBird and I like to dig into the data there. So eBird is this great database where people contribute what they see. So it's only as strong as the participants, you know, in a certain region or place. But when I want to go somewhere and I want to find out what's being seen there, or I want to find out if people are seeing a certain bird at a certain time of year, that's where I go. And they have some wonderful maps where you can put the name of the bird in and the place and the time of year, and boom, it pops up on a map and you know exactly where to jump in the car and go.
Fantastic. Brian in Jericho writes, sometimes in the middle of the winter during a warm spell, bluebirds will appear for a day or two checking out our birdhouses. Where are they the rest of the winter?
Yeah, so bluebirds are really cool because they're like the robins, and they won't always push out of the state unless it's like a really super snowy winter. And they shift their diet. So they can actually survive on some of these berries that are going to stick around and be persistent throughout the winter. Sumac as well. So oftentimes I think about them shifting into the warmer region. So we're not going to see them out in central Vermont maybe as much. But I always think of the Champlain Valley is a good spot for bluebirds during that time of year. So they're going to go to where the food and the cover is good for them during the wintertime.
All right, let's take another call. We've got Linda calling from Middlebury. Linda, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi, I live in a condo and we're not allowed to feed the birds. And in the winter in particular, is there something I can do to help the birds and attract the birds?
Oh, that's so hard, right? Because you have limitations on what you can do. So, I'm going to think big here, and I'm going to say, let's go talk to the condo association about looking at the landscaping on the property. And if this is something that other folks in the condo association are interested in, how can we plant things that might provide good food, water, and shelter for birds? And Rick, this is one of the books that I brought today. I have lots of resources. You know, I didn't train to be an ornithologist. All of my knowledge comes from, you know, pilfering stuff from other people and reading a lot and then going out and doing a lot. And one of my favorite books is by Richard DeGraff. It's called Trees, Shrubs, and Vines for Attracting Birds. So there are specific types of trees and shrubs and vines that you can plant that will attract specific types of birds. And it's really amazing when you get right down to how you can kind of provide a smorgasbord in your backyard, and then the birds will just show up naturally. The other part of that would be, like, ask the condo association to consider nest boxes or winter roosting boxes are another really great one. I worked with the Richerford Conservation Commission and helped them kind of look at some different patterns for winter roosting boxes where birds could gain cover during the wintertime.
We've got Emmy calling from St. Johnsbury. Emmy, what's your question today for Bridget Butler?
Hi, Bridget.
Hey.
You remember the little bird that landed on Bernie's speaker? Did you see that one?
Yes, I did.
And they were saying it was a sparrow, and I was saying, no, that's not a sparrow. It's this mystery bird that appeared on my feeder that's never been, I've been here for about 20 years, and it's never seen it before. Huh. And then there were about 12 of them. They're very small. They're smaller than sparrows.
Okay.
They don't have any kind of stripy crown on. Their head looks a little bit sort of olive green.
Mm.
They're smaller than, I mean, I have a nuthatch and I have a house finch, and they seem even smaller than those. And they seem, in some lights, they seem a little tan, and other lights, they seem olive green, but they have white bars on them. So when I'm checking through my, on the wings, you know, white
bars.
Yes,
very good. You have a fabulous description. A fabulous description. And I think what you have is a winter goldfinch. So this is the winter plumage on the goldfinch. And we're so like latched into goldfinch being like bright, bright yellow, right? But in the wintertime, their plumage is very different. It's a little bit more washed out drab, can have that olive green tone to it or a tan tone to it. And then they have strong white wing bars. And I love that. Like wing bars, if you can look at a bird and you can know, yes, wing bars, no wing bars, that's going to narrow down your choices when you go to identify that bird. Now, Bernie's bird, according to the American Birding Association and other bird experts across the country, was not a goldfinch, but you're right. It wasn't a sparrow. It was a finch. So folks are saying that that was a house finch, which is also another bird that you can have at your feeders during the wintertime. And they tend to have like a cranberry, raspberry kind of wash to them, along with a lot of streaky brown.
Now, Bridget, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, what is Stump the Bird Diva?
Yeah. So it's kind of like that flamingo question from earlier, right? So I love kind of problem solving with people. And I think part of what can be really intimidating about birding is I don't know everything. And so when I go out there, it's really overwhelming. And I was the same way, right? And that's how I started. And so I love a good question that comes in and I say, I don't know, because then when I figure it out, I know I've learned something. So I had a woman contact me from Thetford this winter who was hearing a really strange bird outside her doorway. It was later winter, I want to say late February, early March. And so we knew certain things were going to be around and there wasn't a lot back yet, right? And so she was trying to describe it to me. It wasn't working out. I said, you know, if you have a cell phone, stick your cell phone out the window and record it for me. And so she did and she sent it. I had no idea what it was, but I knew it had to be some kind of bird from the backyard bird suite that we're going to see throughout the winter, so a winter resident. So I started picking apart, and the song sounded a little bit like a tufted titmouse, which they go, Peter, 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 and then they take a break. Peter, 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 but this one was going, wit, 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 and then it would take a break. Wit, 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 and it would take a break. And so I went to the Macaulay Library of Sound, which is this incredible resource online from Cornell. And I was like, so my gut's telling me tufted titmouse. And I looked at all of the audio files for this bird. And what was cool is I found a bird that sounded like hers from Indiana. And so birds can have regional dialects.
Oh, my goodness.
And they can also have a dawn song and a late afternoon song. So the dawn song's all about, you know, establishing a territory and saying, this is where I'm going to be. And the afternoon song's kind of like a little bit more laid back and not as aggressive in terms of establishing a territory. So what she had was probably a tufted titmouse that was just singing its afternoon song or had its own regional dialect, because birds learn by listening to one another. And so they're going to pick up on the songs from other male birds in their area. Like, right? I can see it on your face.
My head's
like,
exploding.
What?
My
Boom.
Head is exploding.
And I didn't know any of that. I mean, I knew a little bit about dialects and things like that. But that kind of Stump the Bird Diva question, takes me to whole other places, and I really appreciate those.
I love that. I think we have time for one more question.
Sweet.
Brooke in Andover wrote, I saw a white robin this morning in Londonderry. I don't think it was an albino. It looked like a little piebald. Is this rare? It sure was beautiful.
Yeah, so piebald, I've heard piebald used to describe deer when they have these weird little white patches on them. Mm-hmm. Hunters, I've heard hunters tell stories of piebald deer that they've seen in the woodlands. And so in the birding world, we call it leucistic or leucism. So it's just like part of the bird is white, but not all of it. Which would be complete albino. So if the bird's got pink legs and pink eyes and like the beak is totally washed out and it's all white, then it's an albino. If it's only got little patches, it's leucistic. And those are really cool. You can have finches, you can have robins, and they're fun to keep an eye on.
Wow. Have you ever seen one like this?
I have. Robins. I've had people send me lots of cool photos of them. And I had a house finch one year when I lived in Moortown.
Bridget Butler is indeed the bird diva. It is so great to have you back again.
It's so good to be here. Thanks, everyone.
And that's our show for today. Vermont Edition is produced by Sam Gale Rosen. Liam Connors directed the program. And our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening.